all CEOs, me included, we don't actually know what we're doing.
They're all sharks, so all you got to do, though, is know shark behavior.
I don't think we've ever talked about this before.
We can capture all of the wallet share.
First place you start is with the product.
That's just the first nut.
This is the Capital Stack.
Hey, everybody. This is David Paul, the host of the Capital Stack podcast, where I talk to founders, entrepreneurs, and investors about all things value creation and startups. Today, I am speaking to my new friend, Al Doan, who was the founder of the Missouri Star Quilt Company.
It could have been anything I was the founder of.
I mean, your LinkedIn's ridiculous.
This is the founder of... it's great to be playing tonight in Detroit.
Founder of Let's Make Art.
I was the founder of... Yeah, I did found that. That was a good company, too.
You did. So tell... Al, break it down for us. Tell us... Tell the world who you are.
Okay. Al Doan. Let's see, the company stuff that I've done. So I'm a man of many hats, least of which is the company building I do, but it's entertaining. So the company that's kind of my crown jewel is the Missouri Star Quilt Company. I started this back in the day, 15 years ago now, started it for my mom as a way to sort of give her a job. Like, the intent was always just to give her a paycheck and help her not have to live in our basement when she got old. And to that end, we've been successful. She has successfully paid off the house. My work as an entrepreneur is done. But we started this company 15 years ago, and honestly, it was just going to be a cute little quilt shop in the middle of Missouri and give mom a little paycheck. And I was off trying to do my own fun, big idea things. I'm a tech guy by background, and I think my dream was always to create the next Google or some big swing SaaS wise that was going to change the world. And in the end, the way that I changed the world was by building a quilt company that's in my hometown of Hamilton, Missouri, population about 1,500, and we employ about 400 people here. We own most of the downtown. Most of the real estate is us. We have 27 buildings downtown that we've renovated and redone the brickwork on and pulled together. And honestly, man, it's a great story. There's so many cool parts of it. We've done this quilt company. That was great. About 6 or 7 years ago, I had this sort of therapy business moment of life where I was like, man, I feel very trapped here. It's my town. It's my family. It's the industry I told to trust me that I wasn't going to screw them. And like, my company, I'm stuck here. Did a big sort of therapy work through how to handle all that. Transitioned out to the board with my other co-founders. We all stepped back to the board and then reimagined, like, you know, like it's such a great crutch, man. A business is such a great crutch for like, oh, who are you? Well, mm-hmm. I've got this thing that is my whole personality and it's everything about me. And let me tell you all about this because I can point to it and I'm really good at it. You take that away and all of a sudden you're sort of floundering a little bit.
I'm a shell of a man.
Yeah. You know, well, it's funny, man, because like I'd sit down on an airplane and they'd be like, oh, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I can tell you what I used to do. You know, because you feel like a dork being like, I do my best. That's what I do these days. I just do my very best. And so like you take that away, man, it gave you some of that existential crisis. And then my ego on the shoulder told me nobody really believed I could do it. And I had to do it again right away and bigger and better this time. And I started Let's Make Art, which was a great company. It went zero to about 20 million in 18 months and just killed it. Just did awesome. And then sold that back to myself because my wife was very sweet. She's like, you're a great builder and you just keep building yourself the same dumb box. You know, like you take orders and you pack orders and you ship them. And I'm like, you're both wise and not very tactful, but thank you. And so like I found my way out of that because I was just like staying up till 3 a.m. packing boxes, getting them out. And then on the other side of that, I tried to do a tech startup where like I was doing a proper SaaS thing. And honestly, like it's a great idea. I wish it existed. I tried to do it venture backed, and turns out raising money, man, it's the worst. And I have so much empathy for everybody out there trying to like pull their money together so they have the privilege of building their dream. And now on the other side of that, I do some small scale investing. We do like early deep tech, like try to be first check into great ideas and founders that we love. And then I do some real estate stuff now. Like, honestly, I'm buying old towns. So I have this county that has 9,000 people in it, Caldwell County, Missouri. And I bought the downtowns of two other towns in my area. And I have this concept of like, can I drop into one of these little towns of 300 or 400 people that has no revenue? And it's just slowly imploding on itself. People will move away and it'll cease to exist. And can I drop in a little bit of retail, a little bit of residential development, a little bit of stuff, and like create, kickstart this economy in these spaces that sort of don't have a reason to exist anymore? And that's the next maybe 10 years of my career. So that's me. That's the history of me in 4 minutes.
Do you put a statue of yourself in the center of these towns?
No, but I should be Donaldton to show.
Dude, I mean, like if I had my own little Sims villages where like I literally just owned everything in it, I would totally make the currency with my face on it.
I will judge the truthfulness of that statement when I walk into your living room. There better be a bust of yourself staring at you.
There should be.
Yeah, no, it is funny, man. Like, you know that saying, change is the thief of identity, right? And like, mm-hmm. And like you drop into these towns that have sort of been the way they are forever. And people love them for the smallness and they love them for the quirks and like all the goofiness. And you go in and say, yeah, this is dumb. Like we gotta think for the future and do something a little more meaty here. And here's the idea. Here's what we're going to go do. I've gotten very few notes of gratitude and appreciation from these communities. I mean, really, it's like it's in spite of their efforts, not because of them that we succeed. And that's all right. That's all right.
They're like, you get a lot of like, you're not from around here, are you?
Well, I am from around here. And so like it doesn't work. But what I get a lot of is just like you know, you think you've got it all figured out. We're farmers and we farm. That's what we do. You know, it's just like you kind of see that anywhere you go in life or in work. And there's just this desire to stay the same. Like I worked with some guys doing change management consulting for a while. And then literally you pull in these change management consultants because you were going to change your loyalty program at Kmart and you needed to get everybody on. Like just the internal cultural shift of getting behind a new idea is so difficult, even in a little company, not little Kmart, as big as Kmart. But like to take that into a town or a geographical region, you know, it's sort of the nationality of these places has to be rethought so that they can take pride in the next generation of what they're going to be known for. And, I'm not super graceful at it. And so a lot of times it doesn't go so smooth.
So is the reason why you want to do this is because you saw the economy boom with Missouri Star Quilt of Hamilton, and then you just want to recreate it? Is that kind of the genesis?
Yeah. Well, a buddy of mine, one of the guys that I co-invest with at our little fund, he mentioned to me one time, he's buddies with this guy that has a big fund, like huge company down in Kansas City. The founder left his kids $1 billion philanthropic fund, which honestly you think is a very generous thing to do, but turns out it's like defined all their careers and wasn't necessarily like as giving of him as you would have hoped. But then now they have this challenge. They have to give away $50 million a year. And he was talking to them and he was like, if we got you $10 million, could you go make another Hamilton? Could we parachute you into some town in Wisconsin and have you just like save the town? Is that what would it cost? And I was like, I don't know. But that's a very fun question to chew on, is like, what would it cost me to go in and recreate, like rebuild the downtown, give enough reason to exist, pull people in, you know, like convince a community to sort of gather around it. Like what would that team even look like? And I loved that question. And so I've like put it on the whiteboard and really stewed on it. And honestly, if I think about the next 20 years of my life, I would love for that to be my legacy. Like found a town or two and incorporate them and bring a post office in and put the first, you know, like give it a square and put some houses around it, put a few cool parks. Like that'd be a great thing to be known for if I had to be known for something else after quilting. Would not mind that being my tagline. City builder.
How many kids you got, Al?
I got four kids. I got a 5-year-old boy, twin 3-year-old boys, and a baby girl that's about 9 months old. And like, it's the best. It's the best, dude. And having kids when you're old enough to like, dude, twins was the greatest. I felt like God was like, I've smiled on you and given you this gift. And then you get to the logistics and you're like, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever thought of. We need two car seats. We need two strollers. We need, oh my gosh, how are we going to do that? How do you even feed these kids? And so like, but doing that as a grown up with a bank account that like, wasn't going to set me. If I was 22 years old, it would have been the most devastating news ever, you know, like, right. How am I going to afford two car seats? This is going to kill me. But it's awesome. And like, honestly, this phase of my life, it is so much fun. I live out in the middle of Missouri. I got a couple hundred acres of like just timber and field, and my 5-year-old rides his motorcycle and he and I cut out. Like it's the best life I could have ever dreamed for myself. It's awesome.
So what are you riding now? Are you riding like a Sprinter van? Like how do you get these kids around?
No, I've got my wife won't leave the minivan. We're in the minivan with the automatic doors, the Honda Odyssey 2019, all the buttons and features. I filled it out, man. It was
the vacuum.
Turns out those things are expensive. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Who knew? Wait, how many kids you got?
I got three.
Oh yeah. You're just getting, so some of my best times were at three.
Yeah, it's like if you have less than three, it's like, you know, I got a lot of found.
Now you multiplied and replenished. You did everything the good Lord commanded. You're fine. You're going
to
make it.
I'm doing good. And we had twins. We went from one to three.
Yeah, dude, it's nutty.
It is nutty.
Wait, did we talk about this already?
No, this is fresh.
No, you have twins. And then your likelihood, once you've had twins, your likelihood of having twins with a following pregnancy increases by 50%. Did you know that?
I don't know. That's probably not going to happen to us because my wife lost her uterus in the last one. Man, but it's cool.
What a jerk kid to take that on his way out. He's like, you're out.
I'm growing the uterus though, because I have all girls. So it's cool.
Attaboy. Yeah. Take one, replace one.
Yeah, exactly.
Are they kind of the same age? Are they like 5, 6-ish?
Yeah, they're I have 5 and 2 3s.
I realized that may have sounded like I was asking if the twins were the same age. I was asking, of course they're the same age. I was asking, are our kids of a similar age? We can just hang out, man. We could be doing this in Cabo.
We should be I'll come to Missouri. I'll do Missouri again.
Dude, come on out, man.
To the compound.
Get those girls on a dirt bike. They'd love it.
Yeah, I know. I'm down. So I'm curious to know, I want to know about this. The crisis, right? And of you going and doing this kind of thing. I mean, you don't have to go super deep in it, right? But like just the therapeutic like catharsis that you had where you decided like, hey, I need to detach. What was that like?
So me and my sister and my best buddy Dave were the co-founders of this. And so we had put together, you know, when you want to start a company, it's you're into quilting, I'm into quilting. We should start a quilt company. And that's really all that's necessary to get started. And it doesn't matter if you're good at finance or bad at finance, or if I'm good at marketing or bad at marketing, or any of that stuff, right? Because we're going to start it. We're all going to dig in. We're going to do this great job. Well, then you add $50 million of revenue to it. And all of a sudden, it matters a lot if you're really good at finance. Are you really good at leading? Are you really good at any of these things? Because that determines the success or your ability to do your job is now constrained by my ability to do my job. And all this stuff starts to like surface as the company hits some scale. And we'd been very adamant of like, you know, we'll do relationships over business all day long. We've got plenty of money. We don't need to do, you know, like this is fine. We don't need to change anything. It's great. And we sort of lived in that world of like the three-headed CEO because nobody wanted to hurt any feelings. It was all good enough. And then like, you know, we had these varying levels of sort of engagement that were able to happen around that because like I was single and so I could give 20 hours a day and it didn't matter. And my two co-founders both had families and kids. And so that we had different hours that we were able to commit. My buddy was up in Canada and wasn't willing to move down. And my, you know, so me and my sister carried a heavy load of like the work, the day-to-day work in here. And so like all this stuff sort of started creating this dynamic of I would sort of describe it as like we all had our own silos of work because we all had our own expertise. And so you look at a problem in the company and I would say, I can solve that. I know how to solve that. Look, I'm going to take this in here. I'm going to go in a cave because none of you dummies can understand what I'm doing. I'm going to fix this and I'll come back out. And then you're all going to be very proud of me. And my buddy Dave would do the same thing. And my sister Sarah would do the same thing. And we'd all be in these caves fixing our stuff and then show back up and like be pissed that everybody wasn't just like fawning all over the great things that we did. And you know, like, I mean, at the point where you're trying to solve like bigger and bigger problems, it became a real issue. And then for me personally, I did great. Like I was a good manager of 0 to 25 people. You get to about 100 people and I had like 100 extensions of my hands. I had everybody sending me a daily report. What'd you do today? And so I had like 100 extensions of my own hands, you know, because I'm like,
yeah,
well, they're like, oh, you gotta, you know, never be the smartest person in the room. And I was like, no, I 100%, I could drop in and do your job better than any of you working here. And I genuinely believe that. And honestly, it was probably true. Like I have a better marketing mind than most. I have a better branding mind than most. I have a better, like, I can do a lot of this stuff much better than the people that I was hiring, especially because I'm a weird industry and I have all the context.
Right.
I know all the things, and it was easy for somebody to come in and make a mistake. Well, so fast forward, we're now 300 people, right? And we're trying to hire these people in, and my insecurities, because I wasn't scaling as quickly as I needed to, my insecurities started getting ahead of me on a lot of this stuff where I had this, the one I always think of is my buddy Rick, who I consulted with back in the day. He's this smart old gray beard that like just dude knew how to do everything. It was a savant. And we hired him in to come help us with a bunch of stuff. And he got in here and I was just sure that somehow he wasn't doing it right, you know, or he was screwing us over some way or whatever it is. And so like, because I didn't really know what he was supposed to be doing, I was very suspect of everything he was doing. And I hired him in to do a job, but like he was doing his job and some other stuff and like just never had very high confidence and didn't really know how to get to that high confidence. And so then I would randomly, we'd go into a meeting and I'd be like, gosh, dang it, Rick, you idiot. I can't believe you screwed this up. You know, and I'd have this like this moment of reaction that was completely unnecessary and way out of line for somebody leading a company and like not helpful at all. And then I'd show up a couple hours later and be like, hey, baby, you know, that's not me. I'm sorry. Let's debrief. We both said some things back there we didn't mean. Sure. You know, and like I was the abusive boyfriend all of a sudden and was like, man, this is like, I'm not me being in the position I am. I've got great ideas. I've got a lot of stuff I can add value in here. I'm hurting this organization more than I'm helping it though. So I reached out to, through my network. I knew some people that knew Jerry Colonna over at Reboot, who's just fantastic human and was kind enough to kind of take me under his wing for some stuff and pulled me into a boot camp where if you got to go and sort through your crap, do it at a beautiful therapy boot camp in Tuscany, Italy. I mean, I can't recommend this enough. So I go to Italy and eat pasta and think about my life and kind of came out of it with like, oh, like I've got one life to live here. I am fine to stay in it, but if I stay in it, I need my co-founders to sort of choose me as the CEO and to give me some room to go and build my team around me. And like, I can scale myself up. I can do it, but I can't do it while I'm trying to protect myself on all fronts. Right. I need, we've got to do it together. They got to pick the path. We're going to go build around this. And so I came back with the realization I either need to fire my co-founders or step back. And so I suggested that I fire them and they said no. And
as like, yeah, funny you should say that. We actually have a different opinion.
I was like, I figured it out. you're fired. They're like, you, what are you talking about? And it came to the other side of it. And we said, okay, well then let's pick another CEO because I don't want to sit in here and do this. And this is fine. It's a fine outcome to do. And so then we did, we found our CFO at the time was my best buddy's little brother and great human. Honestly, I had the Myers-Briggs of Jesus, you know, whatever that one was him. And just a very, very kind, human-centric guy that didn't know anything about retail, but like knew people and took over and did a lot of the hard work of digging us out from under our piles of skeletons in each of our closets that we all had because we weren't, you know, we didn't have transparency and trust for the last couple of years of running that. And then I found myself, I had to like fully exit so that this guy could kind of take his seat as the CEO. And it was, I mean, just a very jarring stepping away from this thing that was simultaneously all my eggs are in this basket. Like all my net worth was tied up in this. Had very, very uncertain about the future of it and if it was going to be okay and how it was going to go. But at the same time, had to give space for this guy to come in and succeed. And so he and I really worked on our relationship so that we could do that. And now today, it's funny because now I got to the end of the 5-year contract with him and I was like, dude, let's tie it up another 10 years, man. You're killing it. He's like, I never want to do this again. This was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Well, we have very different outcomes of what we thought was great about this. Like, no, I come home every day and just like lay on the floor and cry. I can't be the CEO. And I was like, oh no, I misread that at all. So he and I went and searched for our current CEO. It was great. And he came in and had a lot of confidence around retail and stuff. And has very happily engaged me back into a bunch of stuff, which is fun for me. I get to be the chairman of the board and honestly, not being CEO, I get to be a great CEO. Like a good CEO makes their money in like 3 decisions a year. And really should just, if they could not touch any of the day to day and just go work on the big ideas that are going to shift the gears in the business, they would be an incredible CEO. You'd praise them forever. But as a founder CEO, man, I cannot remember the number of times that I ever had a day where I was just like, well, it's wide open. What should I think about today? And now I only work on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and it's mainly big deal stuff that I want to do and like big ideas I'm trying to pull or random in the labs stuff that I want to figure out. And the rest of the time is mainly set aside for like thinking, reading. I'll go and get lunch with people and hop on planes and go visit buddies and that kind of stuff. And I'm a great leader now because I'm not in a position to lead. I couldn't do it while I was, I couldn't get there while I was in it. But now very, very happy with like what I've started to figure out and the outcome of the stuff. Well, and so like from a, what got me to that point it was that buildup. Came up with this realization that like, I wasn't stuck there. I was stuck there. If I chose to be stuck there, if I chose not to be, I could go and create the change and like find somebody else. I would have happily given my salary so somebody else could come in and rent it and done things. So like engaged with figuring that out. Now the outcome is I sit in this spot that feels very healthy today. I wouldn't want to come back into the day to day, you know, especially at the leadership level again, but like have learned a ton about myself and about the, you know, like what this company is on the other side of all that.
Thank you for sharing that. You know, I always think, and I'm fascinated by Jerry's work. I've looked at it from afar. I know a lot of people that have been through it. It just seems to me that a founder-led organization, founder-owned, I should say, and founder-led organization is a life that generally is not very happy for a lot of people. Would you agree with that?
Well, it starts, it's funny, man, because like the rest of my life, I will work to recreate the first 3 years of feeling that I had in starting that business, right? Mm-hmm. It's the camaraderie. These are my band of brothers. We're in the foxhole together. Everybody's coming after us and nothing has united us more. Having twins was the same way. My wife and I, our relationship was better with 2 kids screaming at us in the middle of the night and a toddler that was going to wake up at 6 a.m., right? Like we would run all day, fall in bed and just be like, I mean, we looked at each other and just had this camaraderie that you can't create. With our first, it was her job. She was breastfeeding and, you know, she had to take care of it. Like I was sort of a third wheel in most of that. When you got twins in there, man, like our relationship got great. And the first couple of years of starting a business, that's what it is. And then as you get beyond that, like a business has its own needs, right? Like, and that business may need to not have, like we're all co-founders together. I may need to get you out of that seat so we can take that, like buy you out, you know, in your mind, stab you in the back. But really it's the business needs the privilege of going and growing to where it should go. And sometimes that means you're included and sometimes that means you're not. You know, the hard firing situation, all this stuff. It's a lot of things that you as a founder have to scale into that are not very comfortable. It's all things that you have to learn and then practice at and then turn into, like firing people. I've fired hundreds of people and it's the suckiest part of your day. It'll ruin your whole day almost every time. And
especially in a town of 1500.
Yeah. Especially when, yeah, you got to go to church with these people or your kids are playing on the same soccer team and stuff. And I mean, for real. And so like on the other side of that, I would describe, yeah, you feel very lonely, you know, especially like you got family members that have a perception of what's going on and who you are. And you're trying to make the best decision for a lot of this. Team members, co-founders, all these people that are sort of like are solving the puzzle of what's going on in your head by themselves without really talking to you. And you don't have a lot of people that you can sort of open up to and turn to, especially if you're single, right? See, being a single founder was tough because the successes were boring and the failures were terrible because there's nobody that you could turn to and say, man, today sucked. Oh, I'm just fighting it today. Can you take some of my load? Like not having that was very tough. And then, you know, in my world, me and my co-founder that was living up in Canada, like I started to really fester on the idea that he wasn't here where I could hand off some of the reins to him. And, you know, and so like all of a sudden the people that you have around you that would build you up, like you start pushing away and they divide you. And I would say, yeah, that like it's not very happy, but at the same time, I don't know. This makes me think of like when we built our first warehouse. So we were an e-commerce company in the middle of nowhere. There's no warehousing that we can just rent, right? So we got an SBA loan, went and built a great big warehouse. And we went from a like 800 square foot picking room to a 42,000 square foot giant warehouse that we built. And like I was in cost cutting mode still. And so like, I was like, oh, we need 100 computers in here. I know how to run a network. Like I can do this. I'll set up the switch and do it all. And then we're getting pallet racking. You want $10,000 to set up the pallet rack? Me and my dad will just do that on the side. Yeah. No problem.
Right. That, you know? It was like 3 days of like, right. You know, you like just doing shit.
No. Yeah, dude. I'm just taking all this on. And so we're launching this warehouse and I'm doing all this work. We're rewriting the software. Cause of course I'm going to spin my own picking software. It's cheaper and better than everything else out there. And you're doing all of this stuff. And I wasn't sleeping. And I was like sprinting to this finish line. We finally got it launched. We move physically, me and our whole team moves everything over in a day. We turn everything back on and like nothing works. And it all breaks. And it was the worst. And I'm like, I was just like gutted. I'm so tired. Like we're just figuring problems out. It's taking orders 3 weeks to ship. And I remember like I was writing a blog post that was like, you know, look, we went from the old warehouse that we started 7 years ago, and here's pictures of that, to the new warehouse. And like in the beginning, dude, the first warehouse, we're like, everybody's like, hey, we're, you know, like jumping high fives. We're starting a business. And then the new warehouse is like me and my sister. We look like we haven't slept in a week. You know, we're on the wrong end of a drug fueled crazy night. And like, we're just like exhausted standing there. It's like, yeah. And I messaged her. I was like, dude, look at these pictures. Are we happy? Should we even be doing this? Have we made a huge mistake? And she's like, yeah, no, we're still happy. Like it's still good. But like, we understand the cost that comes with it. And like, you look at your wedding photos and then you look at the family photo with some twins after, you know, like,
right.
You're still happy. I think you're still happy, but it comes with a cost. It's not free happiness. And in the beginning, it is free. It's completely free. And like, you didn't have to pay anything to start a business. $50 for an LLC and we're doing it. Then you go in a few years, man. And like the cost becomes very real. You understand that you're sacrificing time with family. You understand that you're sacrificing trips and vacations and freedom and flexibility and all the things. And so like, yeah, I think there's an element of like, Founders aren't happy, but also there's an element of like, they're still choosing this, but it's not a naivete around the cost. They know the real cost that they're paying for it. And I think a lot of us would still choose to be in it, but like, you know, believing it was free was delightful for a long period of time.
Well, it's like what Jerry would say. It's just like, how are you complicit, right? In the own pain that you're living in. And, you know, to your point, most people, they do know whether they want to say it or not.
Yeah. Well, and really, I mean, just being able to label it, I don't know that it changes what any of us would choose, right? Like a lot of us are happily unhappy in spots where you're stuck.
Is that like a human flaw, right? I mean,
I don't know, man. Why do you stay in relationships that aren't like, why do you stay in businesses that you're not happy in, roles that you're not happy? I mean, a little bit of it is like a marriage. The beauty of a marriage is that you're willing to work through it. And I think it's probably an illusion, like as a founder, I mean, part of it is we're living today like others won't, so we can live later like others can't, right? It's this aspiration for what it's going to do for us at the end, which is why I think probably when people sell, there's very, very often there's a lot of remorse in selling your company, because turns out you, like, the finish line wasn't what you were really after. You know, the finish line was just a piece of it. It was just a thing that happened, but like, you put all of your happiness on the other side of that. Then you got there and turns out nothing changed. And so why are we happily unhappy? I think,
is that a lie though? That like it's at the finish line, or is it the continual validation of like, of succeeding and winning at a scale, or getting like high, right? Getting that founder high every day.
Let's call it an addiction, and I think that's real too, right? Like, I think often we're addicted to the validation or the feeling that we're important in our own world. And like, you know, if I go out of the quilting world, nobody even knows me, but in here I matter. And so like I think there's certainly an element of like being hooked on the dopamine of like, look, I'm doing it even bigger, but dude, it's like yoga, right? In yoga, you think everybody's looking at you. And so you feel very awkward when you're down there doing your downward dog and whatever. And the truth is nobody's looking at you, right? Like they're all looking at themselves in the mirror. They're not, no one's looking over at you thinking, what a goof. And in business, I think a lot of that is the same way, where we're doing a lot of this very ego driven of like, we think everybody is going to be more and more impressed with the bigger scale or the bigger outcome or the bigger whatever. And the truth is nobody cares. You sell your company for $1 billion tomorrow, right? And you have no more friends. I guarantee you have no, like, you have people that are trying to get in your world, but like, you feel no different about yourself.
And those guys sold for $10 billion and you hate them.
Or you should have held on longer, because look, it went even more. And like that kind of stuff, dude, I don't know. Like there's an argument that nobody should ever try and build any outcome bigger than $10 million because the value that you get out of that incremental extra is so small. I mean, I'd love to fly private just because I'm a 6'7" man and I'm a giant and would love to. God, like,
are you really?
Yeah, I'm a big fella, big beard in Missouri.
I figured you're a big dude. I didn't think 6'7".
No,
I'm. Do you have a blue ox? Like,
I'm very Travis Kelce-esque. Absolutely. Paul Bunyan is my man. And
statues of yourself. This is.
But like, even that, you're like, all right. So what? $400,000 a year is what I need, and for that to, you know, like, it's not $1 billion. I don't need $1 billion.
Yes, you know, exactly.
Like, how much could you possibly need? And then, if I could buy back all those years of effort, like I should have, but in the middle of it, man, you'd never let it go. It's so hard to let it go. Somebody screwed you out of $50 million, but you got 300 still. Like, why should you care? We shouldn't care, but we do. We absolutely do.
Right. And there's no, I mean, if you're not making really stupid investment decisions, you can't spend enough if you're 300 million, right? Unless you're just like doing really dumb stuff, especially in Hamilton, Missouri.
Well, dude, if you got 10 million in the bank and it's pulling 10% in the market, right? Like that's $1 million a year.
Yeah.
I could spend that for a year or two, but at some point you start to be exhausted. Like you don't want to travel anymore and you don't want to, like, it takes some real effort to even give that away responsibly, let alone spend it responsibly. And like, yeah, I mean, that's a great max. Like what more are you going to do? How many more millions are you going to stack on there to just keep giving you the challenge to spend more, which is such a goofy, I don't know, like why, like rich problems to have, but all the same, like fixing your goals. A lot of the goals that we set for ourselves, we set as 14-year-olds that, you know, have posters on the wall, right? It's like I'm going to drive a Lamborghini and I'm going to play Xbox all day and eat Cheetos naked in a beanbag chair. And then when you get there as like a 35-year-old, it feels a little out of place, right? Like all the guys I know.
Yeah, he shot a little low.
Well, like all the guys I know that are driving Lamborghinis are doing that because the 14-year-old them always wanted a Lamborghini, not because a 40-year-old them is like, what's a practical car that I could get a lot of value out of and really have fun driving? Like you'd never choose that. But still, we'll push to that our entire lives until we finally get there. And they say, huh, okay. And so like, I think giving ourselves the privilege of like pausing as a grown-up to reset those goals as like, what do I genuinely want? I don't think a lot of us would say $1 billion or especially understanding the cost that it would take to get there. Or, you know, like I want the freedom to just play Xbox all day. It's like, I might want to do that one day every 6 months with my buddies, but I don't need that every day. That's not what I'm looking for anymore. I would choose a different goal at this point.
So knowing that, you know, it takes what it takes to learn things, and generally it's your own experience and advice often falls on deaf ears. What would be a way that you could package up these learnings that you've had over the last 4 or 5 years, the self-discovery in which a younger version of you could take and digest that insatiable, hungry, adrenaline addicted maniac, all 6'7" machine. What could you tell him to slow him down?
I don't know. Like
that's not pithy, right?
No, the axiom, you can't answer a question that's not asked, right? And like,
right.
7 years ago, me was not asking the questions that I have the answers to now.
Right.
And so like, I mean,
what were those questions though? Like, what was the question the 7 year ago Al wanted to know?
7 year ago Al. So let's see. I was unmarried. I was freshly out of a company. I wanted to know, I was trying to find my life's work. And I had done this thing, but I'd been screwed over by being in such a small industry that I needed a big one because my next outcome needed to be multi-billion dollars. Right. And all my buddies, all my investor buddies, now they don't care about my quilt company, but they'll care about this one. And I'm going to show them how valuable I really am. This brain is smart. Bezos should be calling me asking for advice on how to sell stuff on the internet because I know, and he's an idiot. I'm going to show them. This is going to show them, right? Those were the things in my mind that I was trying to solve for.
So you were the disenfranchised guy because you were the quilt guy and you wanted to do something bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wanted to do something bigger. I wanted to do it with people that really valued my contribution because I felt like, you know, my co-founders, if they really would have valued it, would have picked me as a CEO and let me fire them. And, you know, like I wanted the better crew. I wanted the better industry. I wanted the better idea. I wanted the better everything. And I was going to go get it. That was where my brain was of what I was trying to solve. And then, you know, what's crazy about looking back on that now is like, I came up with the quilt company is $100+ million company. It's a great company. And it's a great company because it got to start as a nothing company that could never do anything, right? Like all my best ideas have been lemonade stands that can't go anywhere and it'll never scale. And then they turn into great, great things. And so it's so dumb to sit on your couch and try and come up with a billion dollar idea, you know, you're better off like starting some cool stuff that does some things and maybe there's something there. We'll keep looking there. And that's much more how I've found success. But instead I put all these constraints on myself that nobody asked for. Nobody suggested to me. I just put them on myself because I decided if I did it this way, then I would be loved and then I would be accepted and then I would be validated and all that kind of thing, which is a complete farce. But like the lessons that I've learned through that, I mean, a lot of it is patience, right? Like needing to be patient for, the idea or a co-founder, a buddy, the money, letting the market tell you that it doesn't want an idea is something that I've like started to appreciate a lot more. Letting timing sort of be my own and so much value. The way that I thought I was worth something coming into this was how fast I moved and you kind of let yourself say, well, I know some stuff and that's going to be my value instead of how many hours I'm going to work. You know, you're reconfiguring your inputs, but like all of that sort of had to evolve out of this, which mainly came from like failures and frustrations in the midst of it to where now, like, I'm so satisfied with like the level of maturity that I have as a 40-year-old founder and entrepreneur, because I'm just much more patient. I am much less, I guess, expectant or demanding or flippant. Much more like, I don't know, man. Maybe it'll work. Let's see how it goes. Is it fun? Are we having a good time? Like, yeah, when you the Chiefs just won the Super Bowl on Sunday, which is great because I'm Kansas City man. And they all talk about like, no, man, just got to go out there and have fun. That's the key to performing great in the Super Bowl. And like as a founder doing this stuff, I mean, it's a lot of the same stuff. Like you got to figure out how to keep telling yourself, I got to go out there and have fun. I got to be doing this stuff that I really like. So much of the rhetoric becomes the grind, and we're grinding through it, and we're persevering, and we're cockroach, and we didn't die. That's how we made it. And that's a way that does work, but man, I feel like if you can remember that it's sort of the game that you're playing and enjoy it, there's a lot more fun to be had in that, which comes with like, I mean, I'm not stressing about a paycheck. My family's not going hungry if I don't succeed. And so I have a lot of luxury in being able to think about it that way. But like my best work comes where I can just like release the pressure off myself and try and play the game and have a good time with it. So like seven years ago, me, like completely different goals and focus, and couldn't have, like, I could have shouted this at him with a megahorn, megaphone, and heard it. Yeah. He wouldn't have heard it. Not a chance.
Yeah. So what are you reading right now?
Shantaram. Have you read that one?
No.
It's this crazy, like, epic about this guy who's an ex-con from Australia that goes to India and joins the mafia there, and like just this wild story about this dude who writes the book himself. He's very prolific, very descriptive in the words. You'll get like three pages of what the jail cell looked like and how it smelled and stuff. But kind of fun. I like the stories and that stuff that just like make any problems I have feel very small.
Right. So is it fiction?
No. Which one's the real one? Fiction? Nonfiction.
Yeah. No.
Nonfiction. Yeah. No, it's a real one. It's supposed to be real. Awesome. And then what else am I reading? I've got, I really like the Red Rising series that it's just fiction. Most of my reading, man, it's all just bubblegum. Like I get some self-helpy stuff in there, but I really just want to like get lost in a story and enjoy it. And then
I can't read any more self-help books. I think I've read all of them.
Dude, I did this thing. I called it the Hard Knock MBA when I was very first starting out. I wanted to get into business, but I didn't know how. And so I emailed all the smart people in business that I knew and said, what are your top three books you'd recommend? And I got this list of like 31 books. And it was like Think and Grow Rich and How to Make Friends and Influence People and all that kind of stuff. And you read through, I think I made it through. I bought all of them on Amazon for $300. And because they're all a dollar used, right? Like they're very cheap because they're everywhere. And I made it through like seven of them. And I was like, all these stories are the exact same principle, just told in a different parable. Like they all are the exact same thing told in a different way. And I'm kind of in the same boat where it's like, I can get about the first 100 pages of a self-help book of some new thing where they're like, here's the whole premise. I'm like, all right, I got you. I'm with you. I'm not going to read your other 300 pages of this.
It takes discipline to stop reading books. Like I hate reading, but I do it all the time where you're just like, you're just like, just try to get through it. You're just like, God, I.
Dude, when you give yourself the freedom of being like, no, I'm done with that one. That was boring to me.
That's a great feeling. That's a great feeling.
Oh, yeah, dude, you beat life. You beat the game.
Exactly.
No, books, man, like there's some of those that have been so impactful, but so often anymore, I just want to like smile as I'm reading. I want to like enjoy it and feel very happy at the end or cry or feel some emotion in it. And if I can get that out of a book, man, I'm super stoked.
So what are you excited about at the end for this year?
Let's see. So I'm building some cool stuff with the quilt company. I get to do these like parachute in and take over special projects. So I'm doing some paid ad stuff in here. I'm like, we could be way better than this. Let me figure this out. I'm doing some of that. I'm doing some product work for them. And then, I'm trying to build like in my town, I've got a couple of parks that I'm trying to build, which, you know, it's a little bit of fundraising and a little bit of putting my own money up and then like building the specs out for a park and doing some of that, trying to put some apartment complexes together. We've got this real need for housing out here and nobody's building. And so like, dude, I'm Googling how do roads happen and who puts street lamps in. Like, I don't know how this happens. It's not my world, but trying to do some of that kind of stuff. I think
is there a world where you're in politics?
I'm going to try and run for our county commissioner this year and see if I can sit on that committee. But like, I think there's a world where I'm in local politics. I don't think that there's a salary high enough to get me to be like a governor or something. You know, the amount of time away from your kids and like you trade all your freedom to be this guy that has to play a role. And you're like, what?
It's the power currency.
And then you're like, what power would I need? What am I looking for? All those guys are just these egotistical maniacs that are unhinged. But we need them. Otherwise, who would lead this country?
Totally.
I don't know. No, that kind of stuff is fun. I'm building some motorcycle trails on my land. I bought a wood mill. So I can mill my own lumber off of my trees that I cut down, which is fun.
Sweet. So that's like a CNC machine, right? Kind of like it's like
No. So this is it's like a giant bandsaw that I cut down a tree and I lay it on this rack and you roll the bandsaw across and cut planks out of it. And then I can like, because I joined my woodworkers guild and I'm like learning some how to build a shelf, which apparently is just a board on a wall. But I'm cutting this up and then I can like, I don't feel bad making dumb mistakes with my wood and stuff. I mill it all myself. So like,
then you could join the blacksmithing guild and, you know, get a rank up.
Well, it's funny, man. I stepped like the quilt company gave me a great window into this stuff. But I've done broom making down in the hills of Arkansas with a guy. I've done, you know, my grandpa did stained glass window making that I want to get into. All of these sort of, I don't know, sort of lost trades that are out there are so fascinating to me. Like being able to pull out a chainsaw and carve an eagle. I'm into that stuff.
Yeah, so, totally.
It's so like,
out of a block of ice. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Exactly. And so that kind of stuff, like giving myself sort of the privilege to go and have some hobbies and poke around at this stuff is super fun. So no, I love that kind of jump.
That's awesome. You get down to Southern California at all?
Yeah. I'm in LA at the end of the month.
You should let me know. I'll come up and drive up if you have any time.
Okay. Yeah. I'm actually getting some dinner with Munson and those guys. And so,
and
Drew and Bobby, we're all going to hang out who you're mutual friends with. So
dude, I feel like I need to be invited. I'm invested in all those companies. So
I'll chase
you. Honorary invite.
No, man. Let's go get some dinner or breakfast or something.
I'm going to horn my way in there.
All right. Not even joking.
I'll get vulnerable. You can get me to cry there. If you need me to get vulnerable to be in the club, I'll get vulnerable. level. My life's in shambles.
Yeah, so. Perfect. Perfect. We'll take you. We just need a broken man. That's all we need.
Yeah. Right here, man. I just need to be accepted into a tribe of others.
Yes. Yeah. No, we should. That'd be super fun. Let's do it.
Awesome. All right, Al, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, tell a friend.
And yeah, guys, smash that like button. What are you doing? You got David. Yeah,
hit the like. Cancel me. I want to be canceled.
Leave a review. You don't know how much that means on Apple iTunes.
It does. Leave a review. And if you want a quilt, go see my man Al.
All your fabric needs. Ask your mom. She needs it.
Yep. All right. Have a great one. See you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Capital Stack Podcast. Make sure to share this with someone you know that can benefit from this content. Remember to support this show by rating, reviewing, and subscribing. David Paul is the founder and general partner at DWP Capital. All opinions expressed by David and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of DWP Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. David and guests may maintain positions in the securities discussed on this podcast.